observations will come. As you might remember, I touched upon the life of the man, the Rumi, or as we call him more frequently and more usually, Mawlana, in the last session, and I said a little bit about two major works which are the main heritage from Rumi among us, Masnavi and Divan. For the Divan, we would actually postpone it until later time, but this time, at this session, I'm going to say something about the Masnavi, the major book, didactic book of Rumi, and the way it was produced, it was born, and a little bit about the content of the book. As I said, it is a major work. It consists of more than 25,000 verses, roughly twice as the Divine Comedy of Dante, and you cannot, so my voice to myself is quite loud, quite audible. I understand what I'm saying and I hear what I'm saying. Oh, can you hear me now? Okay, fine. So sorry about that. Just I was saying that Masnavi, which is one of the two major works by Rumi, is the didactic one. He has got two books, Divan, which means a collection of poems, of odes and sonnets, and then he has got the Masnavi, which Masnavi is a general word, and this applies to a style of poetry. But since Rumi, the word Masnavi is applied solely on his book, and his book, when we say Masnavi, this means that it is Rumi's and nobody else's, though there are many works under the same name in Persian literature. But in all other cases, we have to add the name of the poet, such as Masnavi of Attar, of Sana'i, of Nizami, and many others. But in the case of Rumi, we never add this, and this general noun here means what it means. And it is unmistakable. It is Rumi's, no doubt, and no mistake about it. So it is in two volumes, as you say, actually two volumes now, but it is in six books. And it was written, just I am using the word written because I am speaking in English. We cannot use this word because it was not originally and literally written. It was just performed and uttered by Rumi, and then others, his disciples and students, took it down and put it in writing and produced the work. We are not even sure whether Rumi edited and re-edited the work or not. There are differences of opinions. This gentleman thinks that there was no edition, no re-edition, nothing. And it was just what he said, and he never went back to what he said before, because he was new, he was fresh every day. He never thought about what he did before, what he said before, and you wouldn't see any allusion in the whole, in this major, in this big work, in Rumi, to say that we have said this before and just go back and read it, or refer his readers and the students to what he had said before. That is, you wouldn't find it in Masnavi, especially in Divan, you wouldn't at all, but in Masnavi maybe once or twice. Therefore, he was somehow even unaware of what he said and what he did. As I said, every day he was fresh, and he came without any plan in mind, sat down, his friends around him, I said every day, but that was every evening actually, and with his disciples and students around, and he just poured out what he thought and what he had in his mind and in his heart. And the very fresh experience of that evening, actually, without any pre-planning. So that was how the Masnavi was born, was produced. And so because of this, the book actually is a work of free associations, I would say. That was the main style or the main criterion by which he produced the work. He just started off with a thought, an idea in mind. He expanded it, he elaborated on it, and then suddenly something else quite relevant to what he said, or sometimes seemingly even unrelevant, came to his mind, and he went on, moved ahead, and so on and so forth. And sometimes it took him the whole evening until the dawn. I will read you the poems that he says that it is now dawn, and we have stayed up the whole night. So that was how actually the Masnavi was produced. It is the product of about 14 years of the life of Rumi. He started it off exactly 14 years before his death, and stopped at his death. He didn't stop because he didn't have anything to say. He didn't stop because that was not according to his plan. Actually, the death stopped him, and that was terminated by the termination, by the end of his life. Now, the main difference between Masnavi as a book, as a major work, and Divan as a collection of his sonnets is this, that the Masnavi is didactic, as I said. It is the product of the state of the sobriety of the mind of Rumi. But Divan is the product of the ecstatic and the trance state of his soul. So when he was intoxicated, actually, he produced odes and sonnets. But when he was sober, as a teacher, he sat down with his disciples and students. Actually, he wrote, so to speak, these poems in Masnavi. So that is the main difference between the two works. Because of that, there are so many commentaries written in many languages, in Arabic, in Turkish, in Persian, and of course in English by Nicholson, on Masnavi. But you wouldn't find even a single commentary on Divan, because it is absolutely uninterpretable. You have to read it for yourself, and you have to digest it for yourself, and you have to have some sort of sympathetic understanding, a kind of empathy with the author of the work. You have to enter his world in order to get some whiff, some sense, and some meaning of what he has said. But in the case of Masnavi, of course, it has been a book for teaching, and now it's about 7 centuries that students of mysticism, of Sufism, have been reading the book, have been commenting on it, have been asking questions about it, and these questions, observations, comments, all, now we have got them in various collections, in Persian, Turkish, Arabic, etc. So here you are facing a teacher, actually, sitting and teaching in earnest and in seriousness to his students. Nevertheless, sometimes, actually, during the Masnavi telling, let us use this expression, he enters a state of trance, and as if he is now ready to produce his odes and sonnets. Therefore, there are verses and poems in Masnavi which are very, very similar indeed to the pure imaginative poetry, which has nothing to do with didactic things, it's didactic style. At that time, actually, as if Rumi were not in this world, did not see his students, were not in the classroom, nothing. He just was thinking for himself and just producing things, pouring out what was there in his heart. So we can call those parts of Masnavi the sonnets of Masnavi, as distinct from the sonnets in the Divan. Actually, I have collected the sonnets of Masnavi in a volume. Those parts of Masnavi is very, very unsimilar to the rest of Masnavi, but that comprises maybe a tenth, even less than that, of Masnavi. The rest are didactic, as I said, and are there for students and teachers to read and to learn about the mystical elements of Rumi, or mysticism in general, Islamic mysticism, Islamic Sufism. Now, as I said, I mean, there are six books in Masnavi. It is divided into six books by him himself without any apparent reason. Nobody so far has been able to give the main reason behind these divisions and classifications. But one thing we know, and that is this, that after completing the first book, there was a gap of 2 years between the first book and the second book. What was the cause of the reason of this 2 years gap? That also we do not know well. But there are indications in Rumi's poetry which somehow conveys to us the reason behind this. All of this I'm going to read you this time in order to become more familiar with the man and the work, and especially with the style of performing the work and producing it. Now, let us go to the introduction to the first book. Every book has got an introduction in prose. And these introductions are sometimes in pure Arabic, sometimes in Persian, and mostly in a mixture of Persian and Arabic. As you remember, I said that these people like Rumi in the past, it was a tradition. They were usually bilingual, and so they were very well versed in both Arabic and Persian. Now, in this introduction, actually, Rumi tells us a lot about what he thought of his book, of the content, and the goal of producing a book like this. First of all, he tells us about the man who, so to speak, milked Rumi. This word I use it because he uses it. And he had a disciple called Husamuddin. The disciple was very, very admired by Rumi, very beloved to him. And he says very, very wonderful, excellent, and interesting things about this gentleman. And he became one of his successors, actually. Immediately after the Rumi, he became his successor. And after this, then the son of Rumi became the successor of Husamuddin. He plays a lot with the word even. You know, Husam in Arabic means sword. And Husamuddin is the sword of religion. I mean the defender of the religion. Now, he plays a lot on the word. And he says, you are Husamuddin. And at the same time, you are the sun, like the sun. Because sun has got her own sword, and her swords are its light, actually. Therefore, you are like a sun with swords of light, of rayons, and so on. So, and sometimes in a very poetical style, he says that the gardens are smiling because of you. So the smile on your lip actually inspires all gardens in order to smile. So that is the kind of admiration that he brings up about the Husamuddin and shows the degree of his attachment to his disciple. And that was really the case in the Sufi orders. It was not just a kind of ordinary studentship or teachership or the, detached relationship between the teacher and the student. There was a very deep and close and immediate relationship between the master and the disciple. Especially here you have got two of them. We have got Salahuddin, and then we have got this gentleman who is called Husamuddin. Now Husamuddin, we owe him a lot because we are in debt of him, because actually he was the man who requested Rumi in order to start producing Masnavi and writing the poems. After the separation from the Shams, Rumi was a different person. He didn't say anything. He was not willing even to speak to any person. He had his own inner world, and he was living in a different world. So these very close disciples, they were actually people who eventually made him speak and eventually made him to pour out what was going on there in his mind and in his soul. and to share his experience with others. So this man, Husamuddin, was the main element in this particular respect. And Rumi actually appreciated this and mentioned this in many places. He says actually, Masnavi is your product, is not my product. Your voice to me is the voice of God. Since there are here actually students of Persian language, and there are even Persian speaking gentlemen and lady, they have asked me when I actually refer or allude to Rumi to read you the very Persian, the original ones, in order to make it even more colorful and more didactic, if you like. So let me sometimes read you the poem in the original, and then of course I will do something in order to convey to you in a more or less faithful way the translation or the inner meaning of the poetry. No, he said, Pishman avazat avaz khudast, ashiq az ma'shuq hasha kay judast. Your voice to me is the voice of God, because the lover and the beloved, they are not detached from each other. They are not separate. They are one and the same. So that was the kind of relationship that he actually mentioned about him, he and the Husamuddin. So when he requested him, because it was usual in the orders of Sufis, when they sat down, usually they did not recite Quran, or even if they recited Quran, then they did recite some poetry of some of the Sufi masters, such as Sana'i, such as Attar, and so on. At the time of the Rumi, that was practiced. So Sana'i was before Rumi. He is a great master in the Sufi, Islamic Sufism, mysticism, and Attar also. Attar, whom even Rumi himself mentions him, and he says he is my spiritual father. He was the spirit, according to Rumi. He says Attar was the spirit, and Sana'i was the eyes of that spirit, and I am following their steps. So, in a humbleness, actually, he mentioned that he is only a follower of these two great masters. Now, Husamuddin requested Rumi that in order for the Sufi orders and the meetings to read and recite some poetry, perhaps it is better that you do something for us. You produce some poems. You write some poetry for us in order to be recited in the meetings. And then Rumi, actually, the story goes on. Rumi told him that, yes, I have been thinking about this, and I have produced 18 verses so far, and he had it in his turban, off his turban, and he just brought it out and showed it to the Husamuddin, and that was how actually the whole thing started off, whole thing began. Whether the story is right or wrong, is authentic or non-authentic, I mean, it says something that it was Husamuddin. Actually, Rumi needed somebody in order, as I said, to milk him, and somebody who was the real ear to him. Because in the very 18 verses of the beginning of the Masnavi, which we are going to read some of them, he says that not everybody is intimate to these secrets. For the tongue, we need an ear. And so Husamuddin gave him, offered him the suitable ears in order to hear and to digest the secrets that Rumi disclosed. In many places in Masnavi, Rumi tells us that there are people who are not suitable for these secrets. Therefore, I better stop here. And then he stops, and he doesn't continue. So you see the kind of the lively style of Masnavi. It is not like an isolated author sitting in his study and writing a book or writing poems and so on. It was not like that. He was in a very live style, like live shows of TV. So the audience were there, and they put their questions to him. They were looking at him, people coming in, people going out, and exactly like this. And all these are reflected, appear in his writing, in his poetry actually. Somebody comes in and he says, since this gentleman or this incomer is not a person to whom we can disclose our secrets, so we better stop now. So in many places he laments actually the people who are not suitable for confiding the mysteries and the secrets. But Husamuddin was one. When he was there, actually Rumi found him quite prepared to disclose what he had to say, because he had in front of him hearing ears that he loved and he were seeking. Now, let me read from the in prose introduction of the first book what Rumi actually thinks about his book, and then comment on two elements, important elements in this brief introduction that he has written. This is Rumi's. This is the book of Masnavi, which is the roots of the roots of the roots of the Muhammadan religion. In respect of its unveiling the mysteries of attainment to the truth and of certainty, and which is the greatest science of God and the clearest religious way of God and the most manifest evidence of God. So this is the first paragraph of his 2 pages introduction to the first book of Masnavi. He then goes on, of course, to in a sense describe, in another sense to admire the work that he has produced, and then of course he mentions the name of Husamuddin and his role in producing the in getting the book, the work produced, and so on and so forth. But now let us listen to what he says here. First of all, I must say I do not like this expression by Nicholson, of course, here, Muhammadan religion. This is an Orientalist actually expression. We do not use it. We never say to Islam Muhammadan. This is actually modeled on Christianity. Yes, Christianity is a religion about Christ or because of Christ or whatever, but we never use the word Muhammadan. You always use the word Islam, which is of course the best and the main actually description of the religion of the Prophet Muhammad. And this religion, of course, has nothing to do with him. It was not produced by him. It was produced by God, according to Muslims, though, of course, the Muhammad was an instrument only. So, therefore, Muhammadan religion is, I mean, a misnomer, to say the least. Now, anyway, this is, let me read you again. This is the book of the Masnavi, which is the roots of the roots of the religion. Of course, Muhammadan religion is the addition of Nicholson. In respect of its unveiling the mysteries of attainment to the truth and of certainty. Now there are 2 words here which are worth considering, truth and certainty. And I tell you that these two are the main capitals of Rumi and the main goals of the whole Sufi path. So to attain the truth, or perhaps better say to realize oneself, because here truth means reality, to realize oneself, and of course the certainty. You will see when you read the Masnavi from the beginning to the end that when actually he rejects philosophy, theology, all science, the main reason behind this rejection is that theology and philosophy only begets some sort of supposition, not certainty. In order to reach or to attain certainty, you have to follow another path, namely the path of Sufis, namely the path of spiritual purification. You cannot only invest on your mind or confine yourself to science and to philosophy, which has got only to do with your mind, and leaves aside your heart, your soul, the purification, the problem, the question of ethics, morality, and all that. So one of the main things is the business of certainty. Now, in order to reach certainty, of course, he has got his own way, which is going to elaborate in the whole body of Masnavi. And the other thing, of course, is the truth or the realization. These two, of course, has got a lot to do with each other. Actually, they are quite interconnected. To realize oneself never happens, never takes place unless you attain certainty. And you never attain certainty without attaining the truth or realizing yourself or purifying your soul. So when he says that this Masnavi is the root of the root of the root of the religion, in order to unveil the secrets or the mysteries of truth and certainty, so take him seriously, because he means it. That is the main and the major thing in the whole work of Masnavi, in the whole life of Rumi, and they are two main pillars of all mysticism, all Islamic Sufism. He has got a lot to say about certainty, and inshallah we will see that, as I said, when he talks about philosophy and he with contempt, and he looks down at theology, at Mu'tazilis and all that, you will see why. And since actually he was a theologian, he was a philosopher, he was a jurist before he became a mystic, before he became a Sufi. So actually he's sharing us his experience freely. I remember Ghazali, who says exactly the same thing. He was one of the topest theologians of the, not only of his age, but of the whole history of Islamic culture, no doubt about it. But he says quite frankly, quite clearly, and quite explicitly in Ihya ul-Ulum that please do accept freely what I am going to tell you, the gift that I am going to give you. And that is this, that theology never actually make you attain the truth or attain certainty. There only are disputations, suppositions, things like that, but never truth. And the main sign of the certainty is serenity. He says you would never encounter, you would never face any theologian who is serene, who is relaxed. He's always in disputation. They would like actually to enter a quarrel with their enemies, with their partners. But a mystic who is serene, who is relaxed, who is confident, who is in peace, he is absolutely different. So the pacifying effect of mysticism, of certainty, is different from the hostile state of mind which a theologian or philosophers always have got. Sometimes he says that philosophers actually produce questions, even false questions, in order to get their business going. Otherwise, I mean, it would stop. That is really the way. I mean, you have to create some even false questions. That is the main business of a philosopher. Perhaps some of you who are very familiar with analytic philosophy, I mean, this description of Rumi is a very apt description for analytic philosophy. They are creators of questions after questions. And they are just looking for, I mean, darkness, not for clarity. Even if you, I mean, present them a clear definition of something, they are very keen in order to show you the pitfalls in the definitions or the loopholes and things like that. But for a mystic, it is not the case. That is not what they are looking for. Certainty and truth, which produces a kind of peacefulness. So when he says here that he is offering you the secrets of certainty, offering you the secrets of realization, self-realization, that is the, I mean, if he succeeds in doing this, that is the best thing to be offered to human beings, not only in his age, but in our age, and in every age, because these are actually meta-historical, universal questions, universal needs of human beings in every time, in every age. So that's why actually Rumi once said to one of his disciples, who were, I mean, sitting, laying on Masnavi. Actually, the book was behind him at his back, and he was sitting like this. And Rumi came in, and he got angry at him, and took the book and said, "This is not a book to be put here. This is a book on top of whole history." So that was actually what he he had already assumed and he thought of the work that he produced. So far for the description that Rumi actually himself gives of the book. And of course, as I said, he goes on to say that this Husamuddin was the main person in charge of it, and the one who actually made it, got it produced. Now, let me say something. I said that the free association was the main style of producing this Masnavi. You know, I mentioned last time that even Rumi of Masnavi begins with the name of God. It was quite habitual among all Muslim writers, philosophers, jurists, poets, everyone, who actually started off with praising God and mentioning the name of the Prophet and so on and so forth, and then going on to their own peculiar business. But in the case of Rumi, none of six books actually he mentions the name of God at the beginning. Instead, actually, except for the first book, in whose